It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, these are interesting times, to say the least. We're always curious about trends, though, that are coming up, even if those trends are disrupted, as there's no doubt about it that there's reason to think that we're having some disruption going on in the country when it comes to food trends. And I have someone that's been a guest before, Sudhi Bhattarako, and Susie is the president of Culinary Tides. And Susie, you make it your business, literally, to look at trends. Normally, what is it that you're providing to clients and to the public?
So my company, we are trends forecasters for the food industry. So we are looking at all the chaos and noise to be able to have our clients out ahead of trends. So we're looking at government, technology, competitors, food and flavor trends, consumer trends, anything that can hit the food industry.
Now, when you're looking at that, is it primarily what's going on reflected in restaurants and what people are ordering when they're going out and what successful restaurants are adding to their menus?
No, that's historical.
Oh.
what we're doing is we're looking at what they're going to do next. So, and it's restaurants, it's retailers, like, you know, the big guns like Nestle Kraft, it's what grocery private labels are doing, it's what airlines are doing, it's the entire food industry. So we do look at, like, new restaurant items, but for us, that's actually historical data because we already knew that was coming.
Oh, so now do you often get surprised, though, some things that maybe, you know, you had in a trend list and for some reason everything is looking like, this is going to be coming. And then you have to admit that every once in a while, something didn't quite make it for one reason or another.
No,
No.
Well, I mean, once in a while, a trend that should not, how do I put it? Sometimes a trend will behave other than it should because of, like an outside ignorant force that is pushing it in a direction it shouldn't go. That can happen.
You know, I have to interrupt this, I think, right now just to talk about these are very, very different times, as I alluded to, and that seems to be such an understatement. These podcasts last a long time, so we end up having people that are going to be listening to podcasts like this one sometime after we've actually done it. So I always kind of avoid topics that date it because you would like the podcast to be evergreen. And, you know, anytime it fits to come in and say, I want to tap into that conversation. But it's safe to say right now, these are pretty extraordinary times. And we are having across the country reactions to the coronavirus. And many states, lots of cities, the restaurants are closing entirely for at least a while. Going to just deliveries and even supermarkets are doing more and more deliveries and discouraging people from coming to the stores. What implications does that have, that this kind of disruption that's taking place in reaction to the coronavirus, to trends, to projecting trends? Has it hit the pause button?
No, not at all. So what it's doing is our company has, We've already been free, I mean, for 20 years. We already are tracking political and the economic unease here and abroad that has been going on for 2 years. And we've been in a stall for 2 years. And a stall it's not a recession, but it's not recovery either economically. What it means is for the past couple of years, economics have been fine, right? The stock market's fine, the housing market's fine. But what's happened over the last 2 years is because of all the parents that are on that parental trends, as we call them, that are on the playground the last 2 years. So school shootings, fires in California, fires in Australia, hurricanes hitting our coast twice, political unrest, political infighting, all of that causes us and more causes a stall. So a stall means economics are fine, but emotionally consumers have been behaving like they are in a recession. For the last 2 years, they've been behaving like that. We picked that up on research. So what COVID-19 does is it is simply amplifying. It's an amplification and accelerating the downhill slide we've already been in. So picture like you're kind of skittering down an embankment, a steep embankment. Now what COVID-19 did by coming along is the guy behind us fell, kicked us, and now we're flying down the embankment. So we've already been going in this direction now for a couple of years. Heading, that's why economists have been predicting a recession for 2021, late 2020. This is just going to push us there a whole lot faster. It's just amplifying and accelerating what already was coming.
Now, I've heard a lot of people say that this reminds them of the time just after 9/11, the way the country responded. And I had the impression that perhaps at that time that maybe we were going back to more comfort foods. Maybe I heard it from you.
You probably did. So what we've been dealing with in the last couple of years is a slide back towards comfort. When you're in a stall, there's comfort elements that creep in. So not full-blown comfort food, but comfort elements sweep in. So that's why, like, the cocktail scene went back to old fashions and Bloody Marys and, you know, kind of old cocktails, like from a bygone era. Other foods have come back in that are a little more humble, a little bit more approachable. So not as crazy as it was before 2 years ago. So this is now, that whole trend is now going to be amplified. Now we are going to go much further into comfort, into simpler. So it's absolutely going to disrupt some trends that are being forecast or were forecast for 2020. There's a couple in particular that it's going to make go upside down.
So give us some examples of that.
So for one, this is kind of heartbreaking, but so what, one thing we're predicting is the entire trend of sober curious and mocktails and lesser alcohol. Yeah, that's going to reverse. I can pretty much guarantee that. Yeah,
well,
we're all going to start
things
drinking
are so
again.
So bad, they're going to say, "I want to."
Oh, we're all going to. Yeah, we're going to start drinking again. Well, here's what it's going to be: the youngest millennials may not reverse as much, but top of millennials, Gen X, Boomers, yeah, they're going to need a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, and it might be a temporary reversal, but it's that is pretty strong. That trend is going to reverse back to alcohol. At least temporarily. Another trend we think is going to now definitely reverse. It's already under attack. It's already on the downside anyways, is not exactly the plant-based trend, like plant foods, but the faux burgers in particular.
Ah.
Which you know who you are. The faux burgers, which have the 21 ingredients, you know, highly processed. Yeah, it costs more. Yeah, consumers are not going to deal with that. They're going to go back to simple burgers, because it's only meat eaters anyways that are eating those burgers. Vegetarians are not eating those burgers.
Oh, bro, say
so
that
meat
again.
Eaters are so just going to go straight back to meat.
So the vegetarian burgers weren't getting eaten by vegetarians. They're getting eaten by
meat
by
eaters.
Carnivores.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and we've already had research out there by IFIC and others in particular that showed the only reason meat eaters were eating those types of burgers is out of curiosity.
Sure.
They have no better health benefit. They have 21 plus ingredient deck. So their only purpose is that they mimic meat, which they do, but there's no other value to them. There's no health value so the meat eaters, what they did was they ate it. They're like, great, tried that. And now all the sales numbers are dropping. Because that's what it was. It was a curiosity. And now the curiosity is over, and so now they're going back to meat.
Yeah, so it's not exactly like they're not so much because they're meat eaters. They just like sandwiches that have got some juicy in the middle and onions and tomatoes.
It was just a curiosity. It's like, uh-huh. Oh, let's try that. And so they did. And that's what now the current research is showing, is they tried it. So there was a bump in sales. It was wildly popular in media. You know, media was picking up stories about all these burgers. And now the meat eaters are like, all right, done that. Because behavioral research also picks up on that. It's only meat eaters, or primarily meat eaters, not vegetarians, who are eating those anyways. Now we're watching sales figures drop at different outlets, restaurant outlets that are selling it. And so with COVID-19, what it's going to do is it puts people into a more fearful position than they ever have been. And when you're in a fearful position, you end up eating more simply, more comfort type elements. You're not really a risk taker in any area of your life, including food. And so all of that works against those faux meats. But for alcohol, it absolutely supports alcohol.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, I was just thinking, if the stock market hadn't dropped so much already, I'll bet the people in the faux meat business get nervous because they've so much money is being invested. There's like 8 or 10 or 12 companies.
Yeah, but one of those companies, in fact, has already announced for its distributors a 15% discount on pricing because their sales are dropping. And they're trying, you know, they put a positive spin on it, but if you know what you're looking at in the market, you're like, yeah, you've just dropped the price because you're not selling it. Because the curiosity curve is peaked and is done.
I don't want to get off the track on this, but the one thing that also raises a question in my own mind is that supposedly a lot of people were going away from eating meat that's coming from livestock for concerns about the environment, and at least they claimed that was a big issue. From what you're saying, it sounds like that might not have been such a big part of it.
There's not a lot of good research showing that it is good for the environment. In fact, there was one research piece from a university that came out that what they did was they took, if you were an omnivore diet versus a vegetarian diet, but you have to adjust the vegetarian diet to get all the nutrients you actually need, then the omnivore diet with meat is more sustainable.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Here's the other thing. So the intention is good. Oh, it's sustainable. Yes, I'll eat less meat. However, if you're doing sustainability, and let's say so you want organics and everything, and you know other things that come with sustainable eating, that's more expensive. Which nobody now is in the position to do that. So they're also going to abandon, to an extent, they're going to abandon organic, ethical if it costs more money. They're going to abandon sustainability that costs more money in the short term, 100%. That happens every time we go into a recession.
Wow.
Because they can't afford it.
Well, you know, before I talk to you, I had talked to the grocery store that was going to deliver our groceries because we're not going out. And so they called to tell me all the things that they couldn't have anymore. And what I ended up getting back to is a lot of mainstream things like, you know, hamburger and bread and, you know, but when I was starting to identify some of the more fringe kind of detailed stuff that we wanted to get, though we don't have those, you know, we're just lucky to get what would be called staples.
So, yes, yes.
Boy, what a change that is that you start, and I was, as you were talking, it was just making me thinking that we've been forced into our own approach is maybe less risk and more simple. And we're just saying, yeah, we're just happy to get that. Let's get some of those things in the cupboard.
And it's funny because at the beginning of this, what emptied first was like processed foods, like canned goods and so forth. That's what people were kind of buying. Mm-hmm. But when I, for example, would go into the store, I'm a chef. So I was buying like flour, sugar, raw meats because I can cook. We don't have an electricity problem. It's not a hurricane. You know what I mean? You have power.
Right.
So I was cooking meals and freezing them because I could get all the raw ingredients. Nobody was touching those at first. Everybody was touching tuna fish and canned peaches. And then when it went on for, you know, a little bit, then people finally were forced to start to, okay, I have to actually buy the ingredients for things. Mm-hmm. Then those shelves started clearing. But at first, it was like everything I wanted as a chef, nobody was touching.
Well,
and I think because the youngest generation doesn't know how to cook. So that's, I was also like, oh my gosh, you know, have good feelings for little Gen Z and Gen Y, because if they don't know how to cook and they can't go to restaurants, they're not in a great, you know, they're not in a great position. I mean, they don't know how to hunt down Doritos. They don't even know where Doritos live. I got that from
those are the days I remember eating Doritos. But you know, one thing that strikes me as you're explaining that is that where these trends kind of come together, because we, you know, simple and clean and risk-free. And so if you're not used to cooking much, that's another reason to try to do things that only take two or three ingredients rather than be terribly exotic.
Exactly. And also, I'll say, like, because for the last couple of years, there's been a lot about a talk about, oh, we want to eat simple, we want to eat clean, we want authentic. All of those attributes are fear attributes. They only are top of mind when you are in a fearful position, which we have been in for the last 2 years with this stall, that it's fear-driven, it's an emotional-driven response. So if we were in, like, full-blown economic recovery and everybody's in love and politics are fine, in research you don't see anybody saying we want to eat simply or clean or authentic. Nobody cares about it. Everybody wants complex, crazy, international, global, things they've never heard of. But in a fearful position, which now we're even worse, and we're headed more into that positioning, simple, clean, all of those words just even become more important because you are too busy trying to get, like, day to day. You don't have time to think about, you know, how to prepare something complicated. You don't, you know, you're just too stressed out about everything else in your life.
Well, you know, the people that turn the package over and look at the label, and they end up seeing words they can't pronounce that have way too many consonants and at least one X in them. And they think, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I got to avoid that. What in the world is that? And so, you know, the fact that you get down to three or four things showing on that label instead of 17 or 18, and many have no idea that they resemble food at all.
Well, and yes, and that's where the faux meats are probably heading even more into trouble, because now that they, at first they were just in restaurants, right? So you didn't know what was in them. Mm-hmm. And now that they've moved to retail, everybody knows what's in them. And so that actually was, that started the downfall, was when they decided to, oh, we're so amazing, let's go into retail. That kind of started the downfall, because now everybody can see what's in them.
Well, so if you look at some of the basic things people buy, all the regular fruits and vegetables that can, I suppose, have the same demand canned and fresh and frozen, but maybe not tricked out quite as much. But and I would suspect this may not be the best time to bring in, say, a brand new fruit, like, what do they call it, jackfruit or something.
Yes. Yeah. So what the fruits, like, in particular are doing is, who is going to kind of shine for the next year probably are the more, yes, the more common fruits. Let's say pears and apples, for example. But what's really going to rise up is varietal pears, varietal apples, varietal citrus, which has been a trend, but that trend is going to be strong because, one, the pears and the apples, that's very familiar, it's very approachable, there's nothing shocking. So to make them a little more enticing or a little bit more exotic, tell them what the varietal is, like which pear is it or which apple is it? Is it a Fuji apple or is it a Braeburn apple? That's what kind of gives it that fun little edge, but it's still super approachable because it's an apple.
Okay. Now
versus
this,
like jackfruit, nobody knows what that is. Like, most people in this country don't know what jackfruit is or how to use it.
So now this seems like a gateway to one of my favorite subjects, and that is not only the varieties. If you get into the varieties, then it seems to me it kind of leads you back to farms potentially too, where taking, you know, picking certain varieties they're specializing in, or, you know, producing something interesting and special. I know when you talked about pears, it's like Frog Lake, Frog Valley. I kind of think of Frog something or other that's at the San Francisco market. They have the best pears in the world, and they're the only ones that have this special variety, and, you know, you can't get them any other times. But is this, or am I imagining things, is this kind of a gateway back to making sure that there's still a story about how those particular varieties might have been grown or where they're from or who the farmers are and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so actually to have and they've been talking about having stories behind your products for, again, a couple of years. And it's, again, right now it's amplified. It's going to accelerate, and it's amplified is what COVID-19 is doing to all the trends, most of the trends. Some of it they're reversing, but most of it they're accelerating wherever the trends were going. So why a story behind the pear or who the farmer is or the apple or the milk or whatever the product is, even processed foods, even if it's, you know, an older brand of whatever, frozen dinner or canned soups, like Campbell's has a great story behind it. Everybody knows Campbell's. The reason that is powerful right now, especially in a fearful time, is because consumers, when you're in a fearful time, consumers' level of distrust goes up and their level of fear goes up, right? Anxiety goes up. So what a story behind a product does is it grounds them. It calms them down. It grounds them. They feel in control of their life because, oh, not only do I know what variety of pear that is, I actually know what part of the country it was grown in. Or, oh, yes, I remember eating Campbell soup when I was little. It has a calming, grounding effect to have that backstory to a product. And that's why it's been, in the food industry, it's been talked about to marketers for a couple of years now. Well, now it's even more important, is if you want to regain trust, form an emotional connection with the consumer, that goes a long way to overriding distrust, fear, anxiety in that consumer and forming an alliance with them.
So you would have, not only do these brands, these food brands, finding a trend towards it's kind of simpler and making people feel more secure, don't have so many ingredients and so forth, but on the back of their packaging, they may show where their food is coming from or who their farmers
yeah.
are or what they're doing to try to support sustainability. So they're kind of hitching their wagons to the farmers themselves. And probably helping the brand's credibility by bragging about the fact that they have this relationship with particular farmers doing the right thing.
So, no, not really.
Oh, okay.
So, okay, here's the trick. Here's the trick.
Yeah.
Okay, consumers don't care if you as a company have some fabulous relationship with a farmer and you're supporting sustainability. They could care less. What they care about is they are supporting sustainability. So instead of bragging about, for a company, instead of bragging about like who your farmers are and who you're aligned with, what you need to be doing is enabling the consumer to support that farmer by buying your product. So in other words, companies tend to want to be the hero in the consumer's life. We're going to take care of you. We're going to make you healthy. We're going to provide treats for that special birthday party. Companies think they're the hero. They want to be the hero. That is not what consumers need now or ever. Consumers are the hero in their own life. What the companies need to do, and the grocery stores and everybody else, restaurants, they need to guide the consumer so the consumer can be the hero in their own life. So in other words, a company is Obi-Wan Kenobi and the consumer is Luke Skywalker.
Mm-hmm.
The company is not Luke Skywalker. The company is there to guide you so that you get to be the hero in your own life by buying that product. You yourself are contributing to sustainability. So see, it's kind of a different way to approach it.
That's a very nuanced kind of view. It's very different from a lot of what the big companies are doing. I think you're
it
right.
Is.
I think the big
yeah,
company,
they all want to be heroes.
Yeah, look at the great thing I'm doing. I'm only buying from this kind of guy and that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And that makes sense that you're putting the consumer themselves are doing something important. But part of that important thing they do is sometimes they're paying more for products because they are helping them out. And maybe the production practices of those farms are more expensive than a typical, more industrialized commodity.
Yes. And right now, that's why they will sacrifice, let's say, sustainability because of money. Oh, they'll drop it like a bad habit temporarily. So every time we go into a recession or if you're sustainability numbers, organics, all that drops through the floor temporarily. It's completely tied to consumer fear and confidence. Consumer fear and confidence, you know, fear goes up, confidence goes down, sustainability numbers go down.
So if that's the case, then we may be starting a period of time where buying certified organic or GMO-free or whatever, or some other kind of regenerative agriculture, it may go down for a while. And those that would like to have been rooting it for it to go away will say, see, that was just a flash in the pan, it's over with. And what I think you're suggesting is that it may be going down, but it could come back again as people get more secure.
It'll absolutely come back. Every time we go back into economic recovery, it totally comes back. It's completely tied to economy. Because consumers don't abandon it because they don't believe in it anymore. They want organic, or they want, you know, ethical. They want whatever those things are. But if they're in a position where they're now laid off for a month, forget it. They're not going to pay for it. They have to worry about how to get the kids medicine, or they have to worry, you know, there's way more important things. So drops and it'll come roaring back. It always comes roaring back. It's really just a financial fearful position that causes it to go down.
That's really interesting.
It's not a disbelief.
Now, it just reminded me this morning, like I said, I was on the phone with the grocery store telling me what they couldn't deliver. And I was to the point, I said, well, just pick out any old white bread and stick it in the bag. I don't care. I just need something to go around a sandwich. And so I started off with these, you know, very specific about the sourdough, whole grain, whatever else. And by the end of it, I said, have you got anything? Just like a white sliced bread, you know, and they said, yeah, fine. And, and so, you know, you do what you have to do when you're into these extraordinary times.
Well, and again, right now it's a panic. But it's not. How do I put it? So there are some that are, you know, over purchasing, and that's causing, you know, the shelves to run low. But there's also a group, you know, a big group in America that they're used to eating at restaurants, and suddenly now they have to go to the grocery store, which they weren't. They didn't go to the grocery store as often, and now they have to. And that's also kind of causing a run on some of the products, is you have the restaurant users now suddenly having to switch back over to grocery. And by the way, like, I mean, our grocery stores are doing an amazing job of restocking, because that is not the problem. We don't have a food shortage in this country. What we have is we have a panic in the country that makes it look like a food shortage.
Right.
But it's not a food shortage. That's why the shelves get restocked within a day or two. You know, but it's a very odd circumstance that the segment of the population that is used to eating out now, you know, it's much more difficult to eat out. They either are going through drive-thrus or they actually have to cook something.
It's just fascinating, and it seems to me that they're getting creative already. Just you know, people that have found new approaches to drive-through and all sorts of things, and delivery and changing the menu that they could make available for delivery and drive through, and you know, it's going to be fascinating to watch how everybody kind of kicks it into gear and figures out a new way for as long as this has to exist. One thing I wanted to ask Susie is that another area that you've often gotten into is predicting, like, different ethnic cuisines, you know, that were becoming more fashionable. Does that also kind of tap the brakes right now?
No, not at all. But what it does is it does shift. So, for instance, because of all this, absolutely within about a year, watch regional Chinese cuisine to come on board, especially from the region where the virus started. Japanese, for sure, because of the Olympics, whether the Olympics go on or not, Japanese is going to kick up. Australian food is already kicked up because of the fires. So what we always say is, if you really want to start a major global food trend in America, have a natural disaster, you know, the virus is one, have a sporting event in your country. So we've got fires, we've got COVID-19, and we've got the Olympics. Those will all cause food trends.
Boy, that's incredible.
Is that crazy?
Yeah, especially when you're talking about, like, that we're going to go out and get Wuhan noodles or something.
Oh, yeah. That, I guarantee, within about a year, it takes usually a year for it to kind of really kick in. And it may not last. It may last for a year. It may not last for very long. But, yeah, every time there is, you know, fires, hurricanes, an outbreak that came from a particular region, the Olympics, wherever this national soccer teams are going to be for the, you know, for this year, those countries, that's what the food cuisine, the cuisine coming into this country will be. That's what the trend will be.
What
so,
about
so if anything, the flu, or not the flu, COVID-19 will cause a food trend from that region other Chinese regions.
Yeah. What about things like fermented foods, probiotics and so forth?
That's going to be an interesting one to watch because one thing that happens, there's a whole set of patterns that happen during a fearful time. One of the things that happens is consumers do not want anything strong on the palate. So they will not do tons and tons of citrus. They won't have hot chili peppers. And fermented foods, except for milder versions, like they'll eat yogurt, but they are not going to eat kimchi this year. It's too strong on the palate. It's foreign. It's not familiar as much, even though it was a trend last year. That's all going to go away. Part of the so fermented food has the clinical health overlay that consumers are now aware of. So the softer fermented foods will stay, like yogurt, maybe even, you know, maybe some of the, like Greek yogurt for sure. Quark is probably not on the table anymore. You know, some of the other yogurts that are a little bit less from now are probably going to be tabled because of the fears kicked up. You know, kombucha has been here. Kombucha is going to just stay where it is. It's certainly not going to kick into high gear now. It's going to kind of stay where it is. Same with kefir. Whoever was drinking it was drinking it. Nobody new is going to suddenly be like, I must try that crazy new thing.
Yeah.
So fermented is going to be here, but not the extreme end of it at all. For right now, it's going to be killed. That trend, that piece, part of the trend.
What about like people fermenting at home or things like that? I mean, again, people are adjusting, and we're at a period right now where, you know, not going out to eat as much and getting things to go. But some of these processes, will they be tried at home?
Not likely, and I'll tell you why. Okay, so you'd think that, like, let's say we were in a recession. You'd think that home canning, you know, making your own yogurt, foraging, all of those behaviors, you'd think those would be the behaviors that come out in economic distress. Those would come out, right? Because you're saving money and everything. You'd think. But actually, those behaviors are incredibly brave and courageous behaviors because we are not foragers. Right? We're not canning anything at home unless you're like 70 years old. You don't know how to do that. So foraging, canning, fermenting only show up post-recession. They show up in recovery because they're very brave behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. You could forage, for example, and kill yourself with the wrong mushroom. Mm-hmm. You could kill yourself by canning something wrong. You could give yourself salmonella by fermenting yogurt, by, you know, doing it something wrong. It's a very brave behavior to do that. And nobody wants to be brave right now. Everybody is in a fearful position. So those behaviors only kick in post-recession when you're heading back into recovery. Then foraging comes in, fermenting comes in, all of those behaviors come in. Wow. But absolutely not during a fearful time.
So, you know, what you're making me want to shift back to talking about getting a stiff drink.
Exactly. See what I tell you.
So I don't want any of those little foo-foo drinks that are just kind of light and interesting. Give me a hard drink here, I think, of some sort.
You know, and also in the alcohol scene, what's going to happen is cocktails are going to go. So right now, what's interesting is hard seltzer has kind of been at the forefront of everything. And wine and beer in particular are suffering in sales because of hard seltzer and cocktails. Mm-hmm. That's going to reverse to an extent, too. So cocktails are going to slow down, and beer and wine are going to kick back up because they are both a single ingredient. They are familiar. There is no preparation. You just open the can, open the bottle. You don't have to think about five ingredients. Even if you're in the bar, you're not thinking about, like, what is in that cocktail. You're going to ask for the glass of Chardonnay or Merlot or whatever, the beer. That's pattern's going to reverse back towards beer and wine. It happens every time. Hard seltzer is kind of the wild card, though. We're super excited about watching what hard seltzer does because hard seltzer has effervescence, which will go away during a recession or time, fear of time, because like champagne and effervescent wines are kind of celebratory. That's why they go away if you're in a recession. You just go back to regular Chardonnay. Hard seltzers, though, are also effervescent. So, but they also have a health implication, but they're lower alcohol, which nobody's going to want lower alcohol right now. So the hard seltzer is kind of the wild card because it has some things that should keep it in the spotlight, but then there's some things about it that should actually kick it out of the spotlight at during this time. So I think it's going to kind of stay still a little bit, and I think wine and beer are going to go up, and I think cocktails are going to go down.
Well, let me talk about cocktails real quick, because there seems to be a lot of local distilleries, just like there's all kinds of craft breweries have been popping up all over the place. Those kind of hard liquors, whether it's gin or bourbon, that is coming in local areas, do you think that those will be in fashion?
Yeah, and local will be important. Local will be important to beer, like local microbreweries. It'll be important to local distilleries, even wine regions in the U.S. Because, again, local is calming.
Yes.
It's, oh, I know where this came from. Okay, oh, and I may be supporting, without any extra money, I'm supporting my own community. So local is very calming. Local's not realistic, though, right? Because, if you look at food, if I'm living in New York, I'm not going to eat potatoes all winter. I'm going to eat citrus from Florida.
Sure.
But local alcohol is very attractive overall because, again, it has a calming effect because you know where it's coming from. So that calms you down emotionally. So for instance, with wine, we're expecting an uptick in American wines like California Chardonnay, but a downtick in some of the crazier global wines. So, for instance, if you're getting, some unfamiliar varietal from Greece, that's not going to go well. But if somewhere in Greece they're growing, they've got Cabernet Sauvignon, okay, now maybe that would be okay. Mm-hmm. But some of the crazier varietals coming in overseas, that's going to reverse too. We're going to go back to more domestic wines, domestic beers, or if they're global wines or global beers, they are going to have to be varietals or names that are very familiar to Americans.
Like Chardonnay, or Cabernet,
yeah,
or something like that.
So what's so funny is our big joke in our office is that, we always say, if you see like magazines and the media touting California Chardonnay and Meatloaf, panic, because we are headed into a recession. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. It's exactly what we're seeing. We say cocktails down, nobody's ordering desserts on the menu. You see, Chardonnay coming back on, Meatloaf on the cover of Bon Appetit. Just panic now, because that's what's happening. And that, unfortunately, that is what's happening right now.
Wall Street Journal has the wine features on the weekends every so often. And I just remember a couple of years ago, they were having all these interesting, got this specific wine with, this specific cheese. And, had the whole variety, more than half of them were reds. And now they're just saying it's all white, mostly Chardonnay. And I thought, wait a minute. I can't believe this.
If we see Chardonnay on the cover or in a major article, we are the whole office gets depressed. Literally, the whole office is like, "Oh my gosh, did you say? I know it was Chardonnay. Don't even say it out loud. I can't think about it because we know what that signals. It's a much bigger meaning if someone says California Chardonnay. California Chardonnay is lovely, but it is a signal. It is a poster child of panic."
I don't want to go too far on this, except for one more round of beer and then hard liquor. So, beer. So, with beer, with these craft breweries, I love these craft brew pubs, and I go into them, and then they have 25 different beers. The big category.
Yeah.
You either go West Coast IPA or Hazy East IPAs, which I kind of lean towards when I have a beer.
Yeah.
As a Hazy East style of IPA, but they've gone crazy with all sorts of flavors from flour, honey to wood chips, and is that going to have the same sort of thing, that there will be kind of a little less experimental than even in these local
breweries? Yeah, only because consumers are going to be less experimental. That's what it's going to be. Is consumers the sales on the crazier ones are going to drop.
So what about
because
the hard
consumers are just emotionally not able to deal with too many choices at this point. They're just literally going to be trying to get to day to day.
Well, what about the hard liquors? Like, instead of a drink that's got a whole lot of different bitters and all sorts of other things to make a cocktail, are people more likely to just have that local distilled bourbon straight up than a lot of ingredients in it?
Yeah, so it depends on the generation. The for sure, boomer generation will just go straight to straight alcohol, like straight bourbon, because that is what they grew up on, right? Mm-hmm. Xers are going to go back to Cosmopolitan, Sex on the Beach from 1990s. Those are the cocktails that are going to go back up. Margaritas, that's for that generation. The millennials can kind of go in a couple different directions. They're more likely to stick with the hard seltzers, you know, some of the newer things. Mm-hmm. They do like going back towards, they won't go back to the 50s and 60s, right, with highballs, mm-hmm. but they will go back to the 90s with cosmopolitans like Gen X does. So millennials are going to go in a couple different directions, but millennials are very, they are not going to go back towards straight bourbon. What they might do is like a tangerine vodka, you know, over mm-hmm. ice, mm-hmm. An infused white spirit is more likely what a millennial might go towards, but you would never catch a boomer drinking infused liquor of any kind. That would be embarrassing. Would you put apple in my whiskey? What, are you crazy?
Oh, man, you make these crazy times fun. And I tell you what, I could go on and on. It's fun visiting with you. We're both kind of like confined to home offices. We can't go out and roaming around very much. Or I would have you over to have meatloaf and Chardonnay.
I know. And I love meatloaf. And my kids are like, I don't know why everybody hates meatloaf. It's like, oh, they haven't had mom's meatloaf. I'm like, exactly. I know how to make it properly.
I love meatloaf.
With the mashed potatoes.
I have to admit, I've never had it with Chardonnay. But I'm now.
No, it would be terrible with Chardonnay. Don't ever put it with Chardonnay. You absolutely need like a Cabernet or a Merlot or, you know. You definitely need to go in the red direction.
But a decent cheese with a Chardonnay is fine.
exactly. So like Chardonnay is actually terrible with any food. Like just drink it, you know, next to the fire or, you know, your back porch.
Yeah, well,
leave it by itself.
We have opinions in my household about Chardonnays, and half of them are really good. So I've got not everybody is able to have the conversation with you. And this has been a lot of fun. It's been enlightening for me, too. And you really made me think of things differently. So you have others that are, first of all, they're just getting this for free for talking to us. But you offer services, too, don't you, for companies and people that can get a more in-depth report from you? What is it that you do when you're not giving away all this great advice for free?
So we act as a private side-along think tank for our company. So instead of doing like syndicated reports that we sell to the masses, we actually partner in with companies anywhere in the food industry long-term, like 1 to 5 year contracts. And then what we're doing is we're watching their playground for them every single month. And then every quarter we forecast all of their different trends out about 2 years. So our job is strategically to keep them out ahead of themselves, but also watching their competitors, government issues, technologies being born, et cetera. So we do one report that we now release to the masses, which is what we had sent to you, but it is the 2020-2021 trends report. And of course, we've obviously adjusted because we've been watching COVID-19 coming forward for a couple months now. So it is adjusted to capture how COVID-19 in particular is going to affect everything. It's going to affect government trends, travel trends that are in the report, consumer trends that are in the report, health trends in the report, food and flavor trends in the report. We've adjusted it so it takes into account over the next year, 12 months, you know, how is that going to affect what was already being predicted?
And if people would like to see that, where did they find it?
They can just go to our website. It's culinarytides.com. And right on the front page, it'll talk about the 2020 report.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Well, I tell you what, it's always nice to catch up with you. And even when we're having these strange times, maybe especially when we're having strange times, this conversation's appreciated. So, Susie Badaracco, the president of Culinary Tides, I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.